Welcome to Bits About Books, the home for conversations with authors of breakthrough books on sales, marketing, and business. I am your host, Shubhanjan Sarkar, founder of PitchLink, the next generation buyer-seller engagement platform, where our mission is to make buying easy. Our guest today is K. Ganesh, serial entrepreneur, promoter of Big Basket, Bluestone, Homelane, Portia Medical, and author of Mastering Disruption, a practical guide to understanding new age business models.
Value proposition, what are you doing for the customer? Why should the customer come to you? Value delivery, what is the mechanism and what is the method by which you are delivering the value proposition? And third, equally important, not really third priority, is the monetization. How are you going to capture the value? So these three are broad elements of what a business model is.
K. Ganesh is a seasoned serial entrepreneur and the founder of GrowthStory.in, a leading venture builder platform that has incubated and scaled multiple successful startups across diverse sectors, including Big Basket, Portia Medical, Bluestone, and Homelane, which have redefined industries by leveraging innovative business models and cutting-edge technologies. Ganesh's entrepreneurial journey also includes founding and scaling ventures like IT&T, acquired by iGate, Customer Asset, acquired by ICICI, now known as First Source, Marketix, acquired by Nasdaq-listed WNS, and Tutor Vista, acquired by Pearson. An adjunct professor at Indian Institute of Management, Bangalore, and a visiting faculty at the Indian School of Business, Hyderabad, Ganesh teaches courses on new age business models, bringing his extensive experience in disruptive technologies and management to the classroom. He's also founder director of the IIM Calcutta Innovation Park and Incubation Cell and former member of the Board of Governors at IIM Calcutta. A mentor to startups and active angel investor, Ganesh has been instrumental in shaping India's startup ecosystem. He's a distinguished alumnus of Indian Institute of Management, Calcutta and Delhi University, a frequent speaker at global forums and a champion of social initiatives in healthcare and skill development through his nonprofit Bahar Foundation. Now, on to this disruptive episode with K. Ganesh. Mr. Ganesh, welcome to Bits About Books. Wonderful to catch up after a long, long time. So delightful to meet you again.
Pleasure is mine, Shivanand.
You wrote a very interesting book, and it has a mix. In the sense that it talks about disruption and it also talks about the fundamentals of business models. And then you are linking the two, how disruption is impacting businesses. So what made you write this book?
Well, that's an interesting question, Shivanjan. So there are two main reasons why the idea of the book came about. One was, During COVID, Professor Rishi, director of IIM Bangalore, had invited me to offer a course on new age business model to IIM Bangalore MBA students. The logic there was most of them are getting employed or working in new age businesses, business models, whether they go to consulting or the McKinsey's of the world or investment banking or corporate planning, any of these places. And the traditional management education talked about Philip Kotler, Michael Porter, and Clayton Christensen, but did not adapt fully to the latest business model that's happening. So when I started doing that, along with another professor, Srivadri Jha, the idea came up that why don't we actually capture the teachings there in a book? Okay. But I had resisted, saying that the things are changing so fast and I'm not an author, I don't want to get into capturing it. Teaching is fine, but book writing is different. Then what happened was the new age IPO started coming in. Nykaa's and Zomato's and PDF's of the world. Then a lot of normal, common retail investors started asking me the question, because they know I'm a startup entrepreneur. I've done this, saying that, wow, how come these companies are getting valued so much? How do we evaluate the companies? Because normally they are used to PE ratio, earnings per share. There is no profit here, so there is no PE ratio or earnings per share. They said, tell us, how do we evaluate? I said, really, I don't know, because I'm not a public markets person, but this is the way we'll evaluate startup. That didn't help them. And after that, you know what happened. They invested, the stock prices went down, and the retail investor lost money. So a lot of this. So from both sides, from the academic side and the management student side, as well as from the common man or retail investor side, the need to understand the business model came. That is when I thought about a year and a half back, saying that why don't now I write the book. So both these actually nudged me to start writing the book.
Right, right. I think a lot of people are going to benefit from the effort that you put in. So when you decided about 1.5 years back, okay, time is right, let's write this book, what was your process? I mean, what did you start with? I mean, I can imagine that you had some notes from your classes that you have been taking. I can imagine that. But what else? What was the book writing phase like?
No, like a typical startup, we do some research and see if there is a product market fit, if there is a need, if there's an opportunity in the market. I spoke to 2-3 of the friends who have written books earlier. One was T.N. Hari, whom you know, who has been HR head of Big Basket. Other was Shiv Shukumar, ex-CEO and chairman of PepsiCo India and Philips and India country manager for Nokia, who is also a prolific author. To say if something like this were to come out, would it be of interest? I didn't want it to be a management textbook, so it's not academic textbook.
Right.
Would it be of interest? Okay, right. They gave positive response. Then I said, let me go and ask actually a publisher. So I spoke to a couple of publishers saying that if you were to write a book on these levels, most important, forget about whether you will publish or not, will it be well received? I didn't want to do something that doesn't have a need that is there, because it's a lot of hard work. So both of them came up with positive feedback. Okay. And then I took more refinements on should it be academic oriented, should it be general, should it be my journey, or should it be more generic. All of those things we are able to fine tune like a startup, the product features based on the market feedback.
Right.
And
right.
The biggest in this was Penguin Random House, okay, right? Which of course Penguin I know because I had sold my last business studio we started to Pearson, which hold in Penguin at that time. So there the managing editor said, yes, this is a good idea. We'll be happy to publish the book, and why don't you send us a proposal and we'll go through it. So that's how it started. Then I sent a proposal and they liked it and they commissioned it, and it started with that. So we went outside it. So some of the learnings was, don't make it about autobiography or your history or journey, right? And keep it more general and generic so that mass audience would be more interested. And if you're really talking about it being a one-on-one or a primer or an exposure to new age business model, whether it's fintech, whether it's creator economy, whether it's quick commerce or e-commerce, keep it more generic. And so that has been the journey of start, and it has done very well in terms of the feedback I received. We have incorporated it into the book, and the book is going well.
Right, right. So what was your actual writing process like? Were you like, for instance, I have had authors who says that I only write in the weekends, and somebody said, no, I write every day, and every morning I get up, I first write, put in my 1 hour, and then I get out. What was your process like?
Yeah, so that was that very, very interesting. Yes, I'm not a good writer. I've not written books or even medium blogs earlier. And I'm saying that just if not used to writing. And I studied in a government Tamil medium school. So I'm not coming from an English medium or a convent. So English is not my strength. I don't use prepositions, where to use, when to use, how to use, unlike you, a journalist background, a media background. I don't have that. So the first thought was, should I write it or should I get a ghost author, which is used to,
right,
somebody
right.
else to write it, and I will tell it and they will write it and all that stuff. So I asked my editor at Penguin also that, can you recommend people, can I do this stuff, either a co-author or a ghost author, whichever, either way, because this is not my strength. I can tell stories, I can give the content, I'm used to teaching, so content was not the issue, okay, right?
Right.
That was the first question. And quickly it came to a decision that the effort involved in trying to get a co-author or a ghost author to be able to write it would be a lot more. And that is actually true because I tend to work at multiple different times, not in an organized, structured manner. I also have my own companies to run, also teach at IIM Bangalore and the Indian School of Business. So both right. teaching assignments. Right. So in between then, to find time on my own is difficult, to coordinate with the second person is difficult. So drop the idea. So I said, let me start writing. Okay, right? Now, how do we handle the English issue? It's an interesting thing. When I wrote a few chapters, you might know it, I sent it to them. The editor said, no, you have used a hyphen. You can't use a hyphen here. You should use a M dash. I said, what is the M dash? I've never heard of it in 63 years of my life. I'm not M dash. They said, no, there's an M dash and a N dash and a normal hyphen. Okay, I knew only one dash, which is what is used. Okay, right? Underscore is different. I said, M dash, N dash, and this at 63 years of age to start learning that. Then I went and Googled. Actually, there are three dashes. And then I went into the computer. You can't, in the computer, you don't have three dashes. You have only one dash, okay? And an underscore. Yes. And then you have to go through a process. So there has been a lot of learning like this. So what I did, decided to do it on my own. And actually, the generative AI helped. So a lot of the first level corrections were done by Grammarly, which really right. helped. Which yes. for a person yes. like me, it's a great boon. I have an idea. I write like this. Put it through Grammarly and Jasper.ai. So use generative AI very effectively for grammar and correction and even presentation. So this my entire weakness of not knowing when to use a proposition got completely handled thanks to generative AI. And this I'm talking about nearly 1.5 years back. Generative today can perhaps do a lot more.
True. And how long did it take you to get out the first draft?
So it happened interactively. So I started writing, the whole process started about 2 years, 2 years back. So first 2 months, 3 months was all this discussion planning. Right. It took only about 12 months. It was not one draft first. I wrote first two chapters because I'm a first time writer, sent it to editor. They took some time to go through and give a feedback. They said, put more examples, introduce like that. And because you're looking at a general reader, you know, dumb it down. It's not meant for a IIM MBA student. It's meant for a normal person or even a school student who wants to understand how does Paytm get value?
Okay. Right.
Why is Zomato doing this? What is Ranbir Alabadia doing? How does he Correct. Make money? Okay, right. So a lot of examples, Indian examples, and start with a story and keep it very, very simple to read, given the target audience in mind.
Right.
About 10 months to 12 months from the start to finish.
Okay. And when you originally thought, you already had some stories and some examples in your mind, right? When you wanted to talking about disruption and maximizing that process. So you already had a theme, thematically you already knew. Now you had to find more stories to sort of bolster those arguments. What was your process in research?
Yeah, so I know very true. Some of the stories, whether it's the Kodak story or Nokia story or Netflix story, these are quite well known. These are already on top of the mind. I was teaching them at IIM Bangalore and Indian School of Business. So it is not a big challenge to be able to do that. Writing is very, very difficult than teaching or talking like this, right? You really have to condense it because you can ad lib here, you can make it interesting here. You can have a conversation, but there you have to condense it. So it takes, in my opinion, 10x the time to put the same content in writing. And as you rightly said, it also had no need to have a lot more examples. So I did again use ChatGPT and generative AI to see if we can get more. But they obviously hallucinate and you have a challenge. They make it up. But you wanted to focus on real stories. So research did help. Then I had to pick and choose. This.
Of course.
I also discussed with some of the people who are in each specific sector. Okay. Like FinTech, discussed with Vijay Shekhar Sharma. Okay, right. So talk to people to be able to see how does that work. Talk with my own companies, Gaurav Singh Kushwaha, Bluestone, Big Basket, Vipul Parekh, okay, right? To be able to get some more insights to give examples. All of those help to be able to bring more Indian challenges, more Indian examples, because a lot is available even on Google on generative AI. When you go, you talk about international example. But
absolutely,
that really what Klarna does or does not do has no relevance to this. Similarly with Canva, I have quoted international examples, but for an Indian reader, which is what this is really meant for, you need to have more like .NET examples of Swiggy or Zomato or Indian examples.
Right, right. So moving on to the book itself, the first question that I have in my mind is, what is a business model? If a reader has to think about it, is it when I build something, manufacture something, sell something, what is my model? So what would you say when people are thinking of a business model, that these are the three or four or five components that you need to think about?
Yeah, so one is, what is your value proposition? Okay, right? What are you offering to the customer? Okay, right? Value proposition is clearly one, right? Two is value delivery. How are you going to deliver that particular value? Are you going to be a platform? Are you going to actually give it? Or what are you going to do, right? Value proposition, what are you doing for the customer? Why should the customer come to you? Value delivery, what is the mechanism and what is the method by which you are delivering the value proposition? And third, equally important, not really third in priority, is the monetization. How are you going to capture the value? So these three are broad elements of what a business model is. And traditionally, this is not my definition, this is the way business model has been defined: value proposition, value delivery, value appropriation. These are three. And the most common framework is what we call as business model canvas, which has got 9 components of a business model. I've talked about it in that book. It's right. A one-page way of capturing in one page a business model. So that same question that you ask, if you were to come and pitch a business to you or to a potential investor or to a journalist, if you had to say, what is this business? I can give you one page of business model canvas with 9 different components that talks about these three things. We'll not go into the 9 components. It includes right. What are the channels, what are the partnership, what are the competition, all the 9 components.
Right. And to your mind, if someone wants to define a business model which is effective, it needs to sort of address these 3 components and potentially this 9 component business model framework. I mean, if you go and appropriately define, you should be able to come up with an effective business model. Is that a correct assumption?
Yeah, you should be able to communicate effective business model. Okay, right? So if you are able to put, if a new, for example, new age IPO comes up, if you are able to ask them to put the business in this one slide of 9 components of business model canvas, you and I will be able to see it to be able to get a first level impression of what right. this is all about.
Right. I think that's a very, very effective way of thinking about it. So the next question in my mind is that, how do you differentiate frameworks from models? So you refer to a lot of frameworks in the book, and you are also talking of business models. Are they same or are they actually fundamentally different things?
No, the way normally we use models and framework is, model is about the business. You put a business model canvas, you define right. your business and all this. Now, frameworks help people in trying to look at each component of the business model. If I have, instead of starting ab initio, starting from scratch, trying to learn, a framework will help me in evaluating each of the components. Okay, right?
Got
if I look
it.
At a framework in terms of, say, what is the SWOT analysis, for example, is a framework. Strength, weaknesses, opportunities, and threat. If I use that framework, then I can actually evaluate the business through that particular lens, right?
Right.
Or take the Clayton Christensen's disruptive innovation framework.
Right.
Okay, right?
Right.
I can see where is the business or product lifecycle framework. or the S curve, where the companies start, they start scaling, and then they reach maturity and they saturate. So I can see where in the life cycle of the S curve they are there. How are you going to handle the S curve framework in your business? Let's take a simple example. Take Netflix, for example. Okay. It also went through the various S curve frameworks. What do we mean by that? It starts off, scales dramatically, and then saturates. Okay. Now, how do companies handle this challenge of not falling into the trap of S curve saturation?
Okay. Right.
What did
right.
Netflix do? Started with DVD rentals. That was one S curve, reached saturation. Then they moved from DVD rentals to streaming. Of course, helped by various ecosystem factors like faster bandwidth and network capabilities and extra routers and algorithms that would condense the streaming media to a shorter and shorter this one, all that. So that was the next S-curve. Then from streaming, they said that's fine. Now they've gone into content. Okay,
right.
Another S-curve. So when the S-curve starts saturating, then you move on to another S-curve. Amazon as an example, started off with retail, with books, okay. Went on to AWS, I'm not saying it in the same order,
right.
Went on
right.
to Kindle, went on to own private label brands, okay, each one has S-curve, so that helps in evaluating, so that's the difference between model and framework.
Right, right. Let's dive into the book. You started off on the initial chapters about traditional versus new age business models. So elaborate a bit on that. What was the traditional and what are the fundamental changes that the new age businesses are bringing in?
Yeah. So traditional business model is something simple, which old people like me and not so old people like you very identify with. They are based on standard principles of a value delivery. I call it pipeline business models. That's a management word that's used, where the value flows linearly from one end, which is the producer, to the consumer at the other end. What does it mean? Set up a manufacturing plant, produce, distribute, customer service, dealers, distributors, wholesalers, and customer will take it. So linear flow of value from producer to the consumer at the other end with intermediate steps. Typically full stack companies, what are the main drivers? Are the economies of scale. I have put up a capex. If I produce 1,000 cars, cost will be X. If I produce 100,000 cars, the cost will come down dramatically because the fixed cost is the same. Therefore, I can price it low. Typical standard Ford Motors, General Motors model, all of those models, traditional. Cement company, same thing, put up a capex and do that. Even new age companies like Jio works on that basis. Jio puts right. up capex. Right. Infrastructure, telecom infrastructure, they can give data and voice for a very, very low cost because the cost is fixed. That's it. What has happened with data, digital, technology, internet? Things have changed. What is now happening in the new age business model? Take, for example, the platform business model. It's no longer linear flow of value, no longer asset utilization, sweating the asset or economies of scale. You're not talking about business model where in a platform there are two sites, nobody is owning the asset. In the two sites are producer on one side, consumer on the other side. And all that the new age business model is doing is standing in between the two sites, facilitating exchange of value, data, information or services, making some money in between.
Right.
That is the fundamental difference. No longer vertical stack. I'm a guy in between. I'll make things happen. So think Uber or Ola. Think Zomato or Swiggy. Okay. Don't own the restaurants. Okay, right? Are in between trying to make both sides transaction happen, make money. Think of Airbnb. All of those come under new age business model. That's one example of a new age business model. It's a platform
sure.
business model. And of course, you have the creator economy based business models, D2C, direct to consumer business model, all of those, all that I categorize under new age business model, either leveraging digital online technology or leveraging a platform concept.
Correct. That's fantastic. So that gives me a segue to it gives me a segue to the last chapter where you talk about legacy businesses, but you spoke about banking primarily, but I have a slightly different question for you. And I think it links back to this, what you just now explained. You know, if you think of non-regulated legacy business, so to say, not like banking, which are like institutionalized, the family business, family owned businesses, which are like owned across generations, typically exist in three broad categories: retail, manufacturing, and services. These are three broad categories. I'm sure there are others. How do you think they can adopt new age business models, or how do you see them evolving actually?
Yeah, no, that's a very interesting question. Obviously, that disclaimer or caveat is when you are a startup starting a new business, it's a lot more easier to use technology, app, AWS, generative AI, and begin digital first or digitally native first. It's like you and I trying to learn a ChatGPT or generative AI versus an 18-year-old college graduate trying to learn ChatGPT. They're digitally native. Okay, right? They'll be much faster and quicker on the offtake than you and I can be. Just like we'll be faster than our parents to be able to do it. So the disclaimer or the caveat is it is easier, a lot easier for a startup to come and do all this. A legacy business, family business, multi-generation business, it is more challenging. Okay. One, they have existing assets. They have done it in a manner, in a certain way over so many decades. Their DNA is different and they have assets to protect. Same thing happened with, not even in new age now, Blockbuster and Netflix, the same story happened. When Netflix came in and started doing mail order DVDs for $20 a month subscription. It's not that Blockbuster did not see it, but Blockbuster had 4,000 stores. They had huge inventory of DVDs in each of the stores. If they start centrally doing mail order overnight shipment of DVDs, what happens to these 4,000 stores? So there is a same thing with people who had floppy drives or CD-ROMs and all that stuff. What do they do? See, it's okay for someone. So coming back to your question, right? The good news is the younger generation in these family businesses getting exposure to all the newest technologies are taking the lead on seeing how to transform the business, how to incorporate many of these principles into existing businesses. So for example, we talked about platform, okay, right? What are the platform principles that you incorporate? Can I leverage gig economy? Can I leverage existing assets? By leveraging, it's here, make it like a platform. Don't have to necessarily do all. Can I use third-party manufacturing? Can I use plug and play? Instead of being full vertical stack, can I outsource parts and components of it, make it asset-light, just in time to be able to do it? So all those principles can actually be incorporated in existing businesses. And people are doing that. Take Asian Paints, for example. Very traditional business. Why is it traditional? Pipeline model, dealer, distributor, then retailer. What is the challenge in that business? Asian Paints is not in touch with the consumer. Who is in touch with the consumer? The carpenter or the contractor?
Right.
Who is he in touch with? The local market shop. Okay. You and I, when we buy paints, mostly the decision is being made not by us, by the contractor or by the painter whom we ask. He will say this is good, that is good, and all we go by that. So here is a company which is a number one brand, but has no clue about what the consumer is thinking because it's multiple times removed. It has no influence. The other point, another competitor can come in. If you can influence the contractor, painter, or the distributor, they can take away your market share.
Right.
So what has Asian Paints done? Very interestingly, they have started going direct to consumer. In addition to the traditional business,
sure,
they are now offering services. Did you know you can get your home renovation done, home interiors done through Asian Paints. It's not a big part of the business, but it gives them a direct consumer connect to be able to do it. Same thing with many of the brands going direct to the consumer. Take FMCG brands, for example. Through quick commerce platform or through big baskets of the world, they are directly in touch with customer. They know exactly the offtake on a daily basis. Mm. What SKU is moving, how much is it moving, where it's, which geography it's moving, where it is not moving, all that because no data is available. So the answer is use data, use technology, use many of the platform principles or many of the underlying principles of the new age business model into your legacy business.
Right.
That's how you compete.
It's time for a short break. Stay with us. After the break.
And the key common retail investor question, how do I evaluate a loss-making company? Why would it be valued at tens of thousands of crores? How do I evaluate an Infosys or ICICI Bank or Axis Bank or HDFC? It's quite well known. And for the last 40, 50 years, people know it. Ask anybody, EPS, price earnings ratio, they will tell you. So that's when this came up. And we are also, from a startup world also, have hyped up certain metrics.
You are listening to a Business Podcast Network original. Podcasting is the fastest growing content marketing opportunity, which is untapped. We can help you craft your audio strategy and help leverage the wide reach and easy streaming capability that the smartphone penetration provides. It is easy, it is powerful and personal. Talk to us to find out how podcasting can help you build your brand and reach out to your targets like never before. Write to us at bpn@bizcast.in. That is bpn@bizcast.in. Business Podcast Network. Podcasts end to end. Welcome back. I'm Shubhanjan Sarkar, your host for Bits About Books and founder of PitchLink, the buyer-seller engagement platform. Let's dive right back into the episode where we left it. Interesting. Again, and interestingly, it also gives us the segue to the key metrics piece that you wrote about, right? What is it that you need to track today as against in the past? And where does this whole concept of vanity metrics fit in? So I know that you'll enjoy talking about it. So tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so this entire thing came up because people keep on asking, is Q-commerce a bubble? Is this a bubble? That a bubble? And they have seen some listed companies fall down drastically because the metrics are very different. And the key common retail investor question, how do I evaluate a loss-making company? Why would it be valued at tens of thousands of crores? How do I evaluate an Infosys or ICICI Bank or Axis Bank or HDFC? It's quite well known. And for the last 40, 50 years, people know it. Ask anybody, EPS, price earnings ratio, they will tell you. So that's when this came up. And we are also, from a startup world also, have hyped up certain metrics, whether it's GMV, whether all this, in order to raise money. And I've also been guilty when I've been on the other side raising money, position nice metrics that are good to show to raise money at a high valuation. So it's a very, very hot and relevant topic. Very interesting story. If you start following the wrong metric, the results can be disastrous. Have you heard of this phenomenon called the Cobra effect?
No.
Okay. So Cobra effect is from a British legacy Raj. Okay, right? But Britishers were here, they were in control. They found that in India there were a lot of Cobra menace. Okay, right? Too many Cobra. These are how to control it, people were dying. They announced saying that you catch a Cobra, okay, and give it to us, we will reward you with some money. So they had incentives for this. This is an example of having wrong incentive, wrong metric incentive. Okay, right? So that was good. Initially, the number of Cobras came down because people caught Cobras and gave it to them. Then obviously, smart entrepreneurs, my mindset took over. They said, let's breed Cobras. So Cobra breeding farm started. And suddenly, government realized they have to pay money for 10x the level of Cobras that was there. What was the problem earlier had become tenfold, and they were spending tenfold the money, okay, right? Which became a problem. Then they stopped the scheme because somebody was gaming the system, just like it happens with venture capitalists and investors and markets. Then what happened? Because it's no longer available, people had 10 times the amount of cobras bred in their home. They released it. When they released the cobras in the open, the problem which the British government started to fix became tenfold. Okay. This is called the cobra effect. Okay, wrong metric, wrong incentivization, and the problem became tenfold. By the way, it's not just in India. The same thing later happened in Vietnam. Mm. Vietnam doesn't have cobras. It happened with rats. They had so much of rats that they catch it. But there, the vanity metrics or the wrong metric went to a different level. What did the Vietnamese government do? They didn't want to handle dead rats and it creates all kinds of diseases and all that. They said, you give us the tail of the rat. Okay. So the Vietnamese smart people took it to one more level. They bred the rats, they cut the tail, and let the rats free to breed again. Okay. So if you had 10 rats, you had 10 tails, you collected incentive for 10, then you let the 10 breed, you have 100 rats. So there the problem was not 10x, the problem was 100x, because the rat without the tail could still breed. Okay, right? So again, the same result, they had to stop it, and you had 100x the problem that exists. So that is what really talking about. The essence is, vanity metrics like number of downloads, the traffic to your site, eyeballs, all of them are vanity metrics. They are good to some extent. Just like in your blog or in your podcast, the number of visitors to your site is fine. But what is the engagement? How many people are watching, say, more than 5 minutes of your 20-minute blog? That's an important metric. Similarly, in social media, likes is good, but are there saves? Are there shares? Are the purchases are important? So the point I make is, vanity metric is okay to show initial trend, but the problem happens when entrepreneurs, and I'm also guilty of that, I've done that in the past, we start drinking our own Kool-Aid. We start believing in the metric and don't transition into non-vanity real metrics like monetization. Great visits, great number of app downloads is fine, but how much is the engagement? What is the retention? How much is the monetization? How many people are actually reading the blog, sharing the blog, saving the blog and doing that? What is the page views is okay, but how much is the engagement beyond page views? So that is very important. And many of the challenges startup entrepreneurs face today, whether to raise money, not all of them, many of them is because of over-reliance on vanity metrics for too long a time.
Hmm. Let's move on to SaaS, because I think we tackled the platform piece in between. You did tackle that. What new models do you see emerging? I know for sure that there's a lot of talk about usage-based pricing, right? Not that you pay a flat fee or you pay per seat and so on and so forth. But if you use, you pay. If 100 people use it, you pay by usage. So the number of people becomes immaterial beyond a point. What do you see from your vantage point? What is happening in SaaS and how is it evolving?
Yeah, so SaaS has been a great story for the last decade or decade and a half, especially for Indian companies, whether it's Freshdesk or Zoho or this. Just as a context, we started with horizontal SaaS, which was the Freshdesk, Zoho's of the world, Salesforce. Then we moved on to vertical SaaS, whether it's Zenoti, the specific vertical SaaS came up, which also did extremely well from India. Zenoti is a great example. Both of them leverage on the fact that from India, you could create products. You could have people in India doing inside sales from India to the US market, which was not possible earlier. During my customer asset FirstSource days or Wipro or Infosys days, we all was B2B sales with a sales force in the US. Now sitting in India, you could sell Wattpix and others, they did that. So horizontal SaaS, then vertical SaaS came in, then SaaS for developers, for software developers, developer tools started coming in. Things like BrowserStack, Postman, again from India came in, which made the job of a developer easier. Okay, right? And then as an extension of that, DevOps came in. how DevOps tools came in. So we have had a nice evolution of this over decade or two, from horizontal to vertical to developer tools to developer ops, Postman and process, and all of those. Okay, right? Now, what we are seeing now, there are two angles. One, obviously, I'll come talk about pricing and usage pricing. But more important than that is the disruption caused by generative AI to the entire SaaS industry. You might have heard of it. Klarna, which is a top company, has actually given up Salesforce licenses and cut down on the number of licenses, even though Klarna is growing, because they're saying, I don't need Salesforce licenses so many. I can use generative AI to do the same task. So the biggest thing in SaaS now, which people are asking, is how in the age of generative AI, with the exponential growth of generative AI, how will SaaS at one extreme survive? How will it monetize? Can they protect their revenue and profitability because when generative AI is available? And or will it demise? Two, how do they leverage SaaS to be more, to stay relevant and to make money? Those are the most burning questions. Let me give you an example. Before generative AI, what used to happen? The workload flows were quite clear and simple. We needed human beings and managers and executives. They were using some SaaS software or platforms or SaaS tools to make their job easier. Okay, right? A developer will use some developer tool, SaaS tool. Somebody else, if you're a corporate travel agent in a large company, you will use online travel software, Make My Trip or Expedia or any of those. You will use a HR software to see if an employee is entitled to travel, where can he stay, what is the limits, what is the budget, and in case it exceeds the budget, what is the thing, all of those, okay, right? So you typically, one or two managers will access three or four software, SaaS software and proprietary software to do a travel booking or something like that. Today, for example, with generative AI and autonomous AI agents, you don't need any of those software. Directly, I can go into the databases, pull out Shivanjan Sarkar's travel entertainment, go directly, link it to an Indigo thing, actually book it there, because Indigo has got a corporate travel arrangement with my company. I will do that along with payment system, make the payment automatically. So I don't need the HR software that I had earlier. I don't need the online travel software I had earlier. I don't need the payment software I had earlier. So suddenly, because agentic AI has taken over, the number of human interventions in the workflow has gone away. If the number of human interventions in the workflow are gone away, the software that we're using has gone away. So the SaaS software is under threat. Very early days, there are debates for both. But that's one big debate that's going on. The second one that you alluded to is the pricing. You're right, usage-based pricing instead of platform pricing. But what's happening more interesting is not even usage-based pricing. Tell me how much money I save and I will give you a portion of that money. Okay. Outcome-based pricing. We have a company called Verloop.io, which does conversational AI-based conversational customer support, conversational AI. There it's completely saying that you have been using for customer support, spending X million dollars because you have outsourced it to a BPO company who are putting in 100 agents to handle this particular traffic. The latest is we will take over. We will put as many agents as required, which obviously will not be 100. We will put generative AI. Okay. We will handle the same volume, give you the same SLA or better. This is the reason why we can do it better. Okay. Give us 50% of the savings. That's it. I have data. I have past 5 years data of your calls and call centers and customer support tickets to be able to determine, analyze, and say, I require only this many people. These are the 80% of the queries are this, which I can automate. I can put an autonomous AI agent and solve it from the core database automatically, and I'm willing to take all the responsibility. I will train my LLM based on last 5 years data so that the AI agent is able to handle 99 out of 100 queries. All of this is possible and with a guaranteed thing. This comes with additional advantage. What is the additional advantage? AI agents handling it. There's no fatigue, there's no incorrectness, 24/7, all of those. Otherwise, every time any person who has used BPO company knows that when there is a Diwali in India, festival in India, there's a challenge of staffing it. Or in US, the reverse, if your call center is in US, Christmas time, Thanksgiving time, it's extremely difficult, New Year time. Okay, there are businesses like Black Friday and festival sales where the number of calls or support tickets shoots up exponentially during the holiday season. At the same season, you have the least number of people available. None of these challenges exist with the AI. So SaaS is being fundamental. One is generative AI needing the number of SaaS licenses coming down. Two, people saying pay for value.
Right, right. So where in staying with the software space, where do you see the maximum disruption happening? Is it in a particular vertical like say fintech, or is it somewhere else? I mean, where do you see this?
No, I think fundamentally today it is said that more than 50% of the software is being developed by generative AI. No code tools. So software development is going to undergo fundamentally, the base is going to undergo a transformational change, because anybody can code software. And we have just scratched the surface. Even if you have been following closely generative AI, OpenAI and the tools, between 3 months back to today, what it can do, the accuracy, the level has completely exponentially changed.
Right.
And another 3 months when we speak, the level of accuracy, what it can do is phenomenally different between what it was 3 months back. So I think the software development field itself is undergoing a change, which will mean that the power is with the end user to be able to define and develop programs which doesn't require this. So IT services companies, software development company is going to be under threat, because the nature of software development, which was once a privilege of professionals, has become commoditized. So a huge amount of commoditization is going to take place in this. From a company or business model perspective, if you don't use generative AI data that is there, you will severely lag behind. Severely lag behind, because your competitor will be using generative AI. They will have the data, they will be able to target micro pricing, micro targeting of the consumer to be able to provide the needs, which without generative AI you will not be doing. The SaaS software will undergo phenomenal change. They cannot rely on licenses-based pricing. They cannot rely on value they have been providing. While I talked about concerns for software, for SaaS companies because generative AI, it's also a great opportunity for them. If they can use generative AI and give the same solution which was being given earlier, but provide incredible value on outcome-based pricing, they are at the forefront. Why are they at the forefront? They already have the customer base. They have huge amount of data. They need to take customer consent for the data to be able to process. They can train the LLM on the data set that they have, private cloud, and they can provide incredible value. Yes, that 100 million contract may become 20 million contract. Okay. In 100 million, they had 20 million profit. In this 20 million, they may have only 5 million profit. But the beauty is, because they have provided 20 million solution, they can get lot more customers. That is the biggest change. I don't know if I answered your question, right. But
just to take a sidestep, do you think that, you know, Indian IT industry, if you look at the $100 billion that we do currently, a very small portion of it comes out of SaaS. I think it will not be more than 2-3 percentage points totally, including the Zohos and the Freshworks and the verticals and the horizontals, not more than 2-3%. So our our reliance on, or should I say, labor arbitrage is the core of this 97 billion behemoth that we have created. The CEO of Anthropic a couple of days back gave an interview to New York Times, and he said that in 6 months, at the max 12 months, and I'm paraphrasing, these are not his exact words, all code can be written by AI. He was not making distinction that it'll start writing this, it'll start writing that. He said about 50% will go in 6 months. The entire thing. Now, even if you discount that timeline by a bit, even if it is 2 years or 3 years, we have literally millions, 10, 15, 20 million people employed in the software industry. Do you have any thoughts about where this might go?
No, good question. Still early days. My thoughts are simple. The growth that we have seen in this industry is not going to happen at the same pace. Clearly, it's not going to happen, because just like when automation started, robotics started, mechanization started, the number of laborers a plant require will come down. Right? More plants may come up, therefore they may still get employed. So one, in coding, in the traditional coding, the growth in number of engineers being employed will not remain the same, is my one prediction. I'm not hardcore into the sector to be able to give more exact. So, but it's been one, because clearly earlier everybody had to write the code, now people are, that many people are not required, right? Two, because the code is getting written by somebody else, doesn't mean all bad news. Okay. There are still elements of the work which require human intervention to be able to do it. Now, can it be done remotely from India? Can it be done by Indians? All these are questions we need to answer. So, still early days, but the IT software coding industry, humongous growth we have seen, same great rate of growth will not happen.
Hmm.
That's my prediction, but again.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, of course. I mean, nobody can predict exact timeline, that is for sure. But directionally, I think, again, I mean, I'm not trying to predict or anything. It feels that we need to look at it very, very urgently, which is not really our forte as a nation. We don't really look at things very urgently. We like to take a very long-term view. Digital dividend is one thing, but again, not today's topic. Not today's topic. But yeah, so yeah, I think I see where you are coming from. So to wrap this up, are there some interesting or unique business models that you see emerging through these disruptions that are striking and you find them like fascinating yourself when you're looking at disruptions and you're seeing these pockets where it's happening, whether it's direct to consumer brands, whether it is some other space, that doesn't matter. I'm just saying, because you're looking at it, do you see disruptions actually throwing up very interesting, unique models, and where are you seeing them?
No, one definitely world over, can we provide generative AI-based solutions and tools for them? Not the foundational model like LLM, which you leave it to the big tech to be able to do it. Definitely for applying it for specific vertical, specific use cases, workflows require some amount of intervention. You don't expect every manager everywhere to start self-coding this. Right? I think redefining the entire business workflows that have existed over the last several decades with new agentic AI-based solutions is a huge transformation. What earlier in crude way we called business process re-engineering, when computers started coming in. I think the entire, there's a full business process re-engineering opportunity using generative AI, which for the next 10 years will be a huge opportunity for India, Indian software IT professionals, and that will be big. If you look at it,
right.
Like Y2, much bigger than Y2K opportunity also. Right? So I think that is one which is huge. Two, I think separately, not really disruptive per se, but this concept of using gig economy workers, remote workers, a nice combination of generative AI and workforce anywhere remotely makes it a global opportunity. And with our 1.3 billion plus people and available English and all of the stuff, we can play a role there. Not traditional arbitrage, a bit of arbitrage, but a lot more because of the ability to do this. And all of this needs to be done. Like the example that you gave, whether it happens in 6 months, 12 months, that 100% codes are this, that's directionally will happen. Similarly, directionally, it will happen that we have to redesign the entire workflow and processes for which we can use people from India to be able to do it. So some of these principles. Third, I'm very enamored by this entire focus on clean energy, renewable energy, and the way the world is adopted to it. Take electric vehicle, for example. I don't have electric vehicle yet, because I still didn't want to get into the hassles of charging and range anxiety, all those were there. But over the last 3 years, many of them have got addressed and answered.
Yes.
And I've seen enough. My next vehicle is going to be 100% electric vehicle. No doubts at all. Now, that is a movement that is clearly taken up. So what do I mean by that? I'm not saying you start another electric four-wheeler or two-wheeler or three-wheeler. But the downstream opportunity, electric vehicle disruption has given. You look at it. Otherwise, the internal combustion engine, traditional automotive thing, has been there for 100 years. Who are the automotive manufacturers? Only people who are making, who are expertise in engines. Either you are expert in diesel engine or petrol engine. If you are that, you make it. Honda, for example, greatest engine possible. So they can make a car. So the core requirement, critical factor for success for an automotive was engine capability. Suddenly, the rules of the game changed, disruption happened.
Right.
Who is the expert? Who is the core competency? Battery technology. Okay. Because car is nothing but battery on wheels. Tesla, BYD, you take now Ola, electric. There is no concept of engine. Otherwise, for decades, a century, it has been engine manufacturers. That's a core competency. So the opportunity where it gives you is all downstream, battery swapping, battery manufacturing, battery waste disposal, electronic waste disposal. All of those opportunities are huge because of one disruption that has taken place. Don't fight, don't try to manufacture another electric vehicle. Let the biggies do it. But for each one who succeeds, four other will not succeed. But downstream, all of them will produce batteries. So you require battery swapping, battery manufacturing, battery components, battery wastage, all of that. Just like what they say, you know, when there was a gold rush, the people who made money was not the people who were doing, people who were making shovels. So many of this disruption gives you a lot of downstream opportunities.
Right.
Just like your UPI and digital payment gave rise to opportunities for small micro entrepreneurs to be able to sell, whether it's micro insurance or micro credit or 1 rupee, 2 rupee, I can actually give you 2 rupees now, okay, right? And make two rupees money, which was impossible before digital payment. So I think all those are opportunities that exist. I am very, very bullish about the opportunities. It's scary at one level because the traditional rules of the game have changed, but it's great news if you are young, if you don't have legacy baggage holding you back, then it's a new, open, virgin, green field for you to go and capture.
Limited by your imagination, huh?
Limited by your imagination.
Bits About Books is brought to you by PitchLink, the buyer-seller engagement platform. PitchLink makes buying easy by enabling high-quality engagement between buyers and sellers through its presentation and discussion modules. Sellers create customized sales narratives using sales collaterals and personal videos and reach out to prospects through a non-intrusive, buyer-qualified engagement. PitchLink requires no installation or download and holds the entire repository of sales collaterals and buyer-seller conversations. Talk to us to know more about how you can engage with customers without intrusion. Call us on 99021-631-32.
Mr. Ganesh, thank you so much. This was an interesting discussion. But in all fairness, before I say goodbye, would you like to touch upon anything else? We touched quite a few things, but maybe we left out some things that you wanted to talk about. Anything you would like to add to this?
No, I think we covered comprehensively, but a message really is we live in very, very, very interesting times. Okay, right? And whether you are young, you are a student, you are practicing professional, mid-level manager, middle-aged person, or people like me, 60 plus, it's extremely interesting times with new changes that are taking place and just keeping your minds open.
Right.
You can see fascinating opportunities, whether for profit or just for interest sake. I think so. Keep your mind open. Keep learning.
Thank you. Thank you so much. We have a fantastic lineup over the next couple of episodes with great conversations on breakthrough books. Subscribe in your favorite podcast app so you do not miss a single episode. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for being with us today on Bits About Books, where we talk to authors about breakthrough books on sales, marketing, and business. We hope this conversation helped inform and motivate as we all navigate a rapidly changing business environment. For us, these are enlightening conversations enriched with knowledge and expertise. We encourage you to go out and buy the book to learn firsthand and implement some of the great ideas we discussed today. We hope to have you with us again in the next exciting episode of Bits About Books. If you liked what you heard, subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast platforms like iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcast from, and give us a rating while you are at it.
This BizCast original podcast is produced for PitchLink, the next generation buyer-seller engagement platform, where the mission is to make buying easy. Hosted by Subhanjan Sarkar and produced by Rajiv Aditya. See you next time and have a wonderful day.